This CLE is based on New York State appellate decisions released in January 2020 dealing with issues related to negligence. Selected decisions were summarized and the summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in January of 2020. And those summaries have since been collected into the January 2020 Negligence Update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet that serves as the written materials for the CLE. And the page references are to the pages in the pamphlet. The first case is Pruss versus Infinity of Manhattan on page 6. It has to do with a stipulated settlement and ratification of that settlement. First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice DaCosta, held that the defendants, called the Infinity defendants, were bound by an open court stipulated settlement of $8,875,000 in this personal injury case. The attorneys had apparent authority to bind the defendants, and the defendants ratified the stipulation by failing to timely object to it. The court wrote, "The fact that one of the insurers is now unable to pay its intended $5 million portion does not inure to the Infinity defendants' benefit. Rather, the Infinity defendants are responsible for the portion of the agreed-upon amounts that the insurers do not pay. To accept their position would alter the way litigation is conducted in New York State. Courts would have to conduct colloquies in every case to make sure that the parties, notwithstanding their attorneys' actions in appearing for them on numerous occasions and signing stipulations, acquiesced in the terms of the stipulations. That is unacceptable, especially here, where the Infinity defendants never objected to the stipulation until the filing of the instant order to show cause more than a year and 6 months after the stipulation was signed in open court." Next is Neves on page 7. A $1 million verdict was overturned because of the plaintiff's counsel's remarks in summation. Second Department, reversing the over $1 million judgment in this negligence and public health law 2801D violation case, held plaintiff's counsel's remarks in summation required a new trial. Plaintiff's decedent, who was at risk for falling, fell after getting up from a wheelchair at defendant residential health care facility and ultimately died. The court wrote, "Here during summation, the plaintiff's counsel improperly appealed to the passion of the jurors by characterizing the defendant as a corporation that has two lawyers, a tech person, general counsel, and video people. Counsel also improperly accused the defendant of willfully depriving the plaintiff of evidence that would have been harmful to the defendant's case, accused the defendant's witnesses of having changed their testimony after their depositions or pretrial affirmations, which were not in evidence, because they saw they couldn't win, and improperly argued that the defendant failed to call certain witnesses who were not under defendant's control. Thus, the comments of the plaintiff's counsel were not isolated, were inflammatory, and were unduly prejudicial. These prejudicial comments so tainted the proceedings as to have deprived the defendant of a fair trial." Next is Ramsey on page 8, dealing with the Espinalis exceptions. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant cleaning service contractor's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. Plaintiff alleged defendant was liable under Espinal for launching or creating an instrument of harm by mopping the floor without placing warning signs in the area where she fell. The court said, "Generally, a contractual obligation standing alone will not give rise to tort liability in favor of a third party," citing Espinal versus Melville Snow Contractors, 98 New York 2nd, 136. However, there are three exceptions to the general rule. Here, the plaintiff alleged only one of the Espinal exceptions, that the defendant created or launched an instrument of harm. Thus, in support of its motion for summary judgment dismissing the complaint, the defendant was required to establish that it did not create or launch an instrument of harm. The defendant's submissions demonstrated the existence of tribal issues of fact regarding the location of wet floor signs and whether the wet floor or the signs were readily observable by a reasonable use of the plaintiff's senses as she entered the area through a closed door. Thus, the defendant failed to establish that it did not create the condition that caused plaintiff to fall or that it provided adequate notice of the alleged hazardous condition. Next is Hamlin, which is on page 9, and it deals with the unique liability of health clubs to patrons. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion for summary judgment against defendant health club for failing to aid plaintiff's decedent when she had a heart attack at the club should have been granted. The only club employee on duty, whose name was Higgins, was not certified to provide emergency aid and delayed in calling 911. The court wrote, in Maglino versus Bally Total Fitness of Greater New York, the Court of Appeals recognized that New York courts have viewed health clubs as owing a limited duty of care to patrons struck down by a heart attack or cardiac arrest while engaged in athletic activities on the premises. The Court of Appeals has referred to this limited duty as the health club's common law duty to render aid. A health club fulfills this duty, for example, by calling 911 immediately, responding to the patron and performing CPR or other measures, or responding to the patron and then deferring to someone else with superior medical training. So under that criteria, the plaintiff in this case was entitled to summary judgment. Next is the Unitrin Auto and Home Insurance Company case on pages 9 and 10. It's a dispute about whether the injury was covered by the insurer. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's insurer, that's Unitrin's, motion for summary judgment in this insurance coverage dispute should not have been granted. Apparently, Sullivan was in one car, and the injured party, Simonello, was in another car when Sullivan allegedly attempted to throw liquid that was in a cup into Simonello's car. It was alleged that Sullivan unintentionally threw the entire cup, not just its contents, which injured Simonello. So there was a question of fact whether Simonello was injured by intentional conduct, which is not covered by the insurance, or an accident, which would be covered. As the court said, as the instant case does not fall within the narrow class of cases in which the intentional act exclusion applies regardless of the insured's subjective intent, there is a triable issue of fact as to whether the event qualified as an accident as defined by the policy. Next is Farm Family Casualty Insurance Company on pages 10 and 11. Another insurance coverage case. The Third Department held plaintiff insurer was obligated to defend in this personal injury case stemming from the unloading of a tractor from a flatbed truck owned by the insured. The tractor rolled over the insured's son as it was being unloaded from the flatbed truck. The son and his wife sued the insured and the insured's farm. Plaintiff Carrier brought this action for a declaratory judgment that it was not obligated to defend or indemnify, apparently claiming that the insured's truck was not being operated when the accident occurred. The court wrote, loading and unloading of a covered vehicle constitute use or operation pursuant to Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 388, Subdivision 1, and a vehicle does not have to be in motion to be in use or operation. And therefore, the insurance company was obligated to defend and indemnify. Next is Nelson on pages 11 and 12. It has to do with the special affidavit requirements when a out-of-state doctor submits evidence in a New York case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the statement by a New Jersey dentist offered by the plaintiff in this dental malpractice action was not admissible because it was not in the form of a sworn affidavit. Therefore, plaintiff did not raise a question of fact in opposition to the defendant's motions for summary judgment. Court wrote, while an otherwise qualified expert physician, osteopath, or dentist who is not licensed in this state may submit a statement in support of or in opposition to a party's position in a case, that statement must be in the form of a sworn affidavit. CPLR 2106 subdivision A, which permits such a statement to be in the form of an affirmation, only applies to attorneys, physicians, osteopaths, and dentists licensed to practice in the state of New York. So submission of an affirmation from the out-of-state dentist in this case failed to raise a question of fact, where the submission of an affidavit from the same dentist may have raised a question of fact. Next is the Robbins case on page 12 and 13. First Department, it's a medical malpractice case. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the New Jersey defendant, Princeton Radiology Associates, and the associated defendant, doctors, had demonstrated New York did not have jurisdiction over them in this medical malpractice case. But with regard to another related New Jersey defendant, Princeton Procure Management, the First Department held its lack of jurisdiction affirmative defense should not have been dismissed, and a jury must decide the issue. So whether the court had jurisdiction over one of these out-of-state defendants was left to be decided by the jury. Next is Romanelli on pages 13 and 14, another medical malpractice case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice action should not have been granted. Defendant, Lascalle, is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist specializing in maternal-fetal medicine. Plaintiff's decedent died in childbirth when she was assisted at home by a certified nurse midwife, whose name was Moss Jones. Plaintiffs alleged Lascalle negligently failed to advise decedent and Moss Jones of the dangers of a home birth given the baby's size and the fact decedent had previously given birth by cesarean section. Lascalle argued his limited role, analyzing periodic sonograms, did not include advice on delivery. The court wrote, although Lascalle, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, purported to limit the scope of his duty to the field of maternal-fetal medicine and the performance and interpretation of ultrasounds, it was within such limited scope of duty to consult with the decedent and Moss Jones concerning his diagnosis of suspected fetal macrosomia, that meaning the baby was very large, and how such diagnosis would increase the risks of vaginal birth after cesarean section home birth, given all of the other risk factors that were present. Given such risks, it was also within the scope of Lascalle's duty to advise to the decedent and Moss Jones against proceeding with the planned home birth. The court went on, when a question of proximate cause involves an intervening act, liability turns upon whether the intervening act is a normal or foreseeable consequence of the situation created by the defendant's negligence. It is only where the intervening act is extraordinary under the circumstances, not foreseeable in the normal course of events, or independent of or far removed from the defendant's conduct, that it may possibly break the causal nexus. Whether the decedent would have heeded appropriate warnings and advice by Lascalle in light of the purported warning she was given by Moss Jones or her own views is for the jury to decide. Next is the Fussell case, F-U-E-S-S-E-L versus Chin, pages 16 and 17, another medical malpractice case. Second Department held there was a question of fact whether the hospital, Good Samaritan, was vicariously liable for the alleged malpractice of a physician named Chin, who, although not a hospital employee, treated plaintiff in the hospital emergency room. The court wrote, in general, under the doctrine of respondeat superior, a hospital may be held vicariously liable for the negligence or malpractice of its employees acting within the scope of employment, but not for negligent treatment provided by an independent physician, as when the physician is retained by the patient himself. However, an exception to this general rule exists where a plaintiff seeks to hold a hospital vicariously liable for the alleged malpractice of an attending physician who is not its employee, where a patient comes to the emergency room seeking treatment from the hospital and not from a particular physician of the patient's choosing. So under that exception to the rule, a hospital can be vicariously liable for the acts of a non-employee. Next is Serrano on pages 17 and 18. It's another medical malpractice case. It was held in front of a judge in the Court of Claims, and the appellate court determined that the damages were not sufficient. Third Department, reversing the Court of Claims, held the conflicting expert evidence credited by the Court of Claims forced the conclusion claimant suffered some permanent damage to his heart. Therefore, awarding nothing for future pain and suffering was error. The Third Department awarded an additional $10,000. The court wrote, the court accepted, talking about the Court of Claims, the Court of Claims accepted aspects of both experts' opinions, crediting both the opinion of defendant's expert cardiologist that claimant had suffered no significant permanent damage, and simultaneously crediting the opinion of claimant's expert cardiologist that claimant could develop future arrhythmia because of his injury. As claimant argues, and based upon our review of the record, we find these opinions to be inconsistent with one another. In order to accept the opinion that claimant's risk of suffering a future arrhythmia was increased, the court must necessarily also have credited the cardiologist's opinion that claimant had suffered some, albeit limited, degree of permanent injury. Next is Pui Kum Nig Lee versus Chatham Green Incorporated on page 18, a premises liability case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined that the defendant's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. And the defendants here were either the property owner or manager or both. Plaintiff alleged the door to a wheelchair lift on the exterior of the building where the plaintiffs lived malfunctioned, causing plaintiff's decedent to fall out of the lift. The defendants presented evidence they did not have notice of any problems with the door. The court wrote, defendants established entitlement to judgment as a matter of law in this action, where plaintiff's decedent was injured when the door to the wheelchair lift on the exterior of the building in which they lived malfunctioned, causing him to fall out of the lift. Defendants submitted evidence demonstrating that they did not have notice of any malfunction in the subject door through service records showing no issues related to the door opening prematurely. In opposition, plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact. Plaintiff did not submit any evidence that complaints about the lift were similar in nature or caused by similar contributing factors. Nor is the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur applicable under the circumstances here. Next is Kelly versus Roy C. Ketchum High School on page 19. It's another premises liability case. Second Department held that the defendant's school did not demonstrate it lacked constructive notice of the protruding screw which allegedly lacerated plaintiff student's leg as she walked by bleachers. Therefore, the school's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. The court wrote, the defendant submitted the affidavit of the school district's director of facilities, Raoul Bros, who averred in relevant part that the school district did not maintain the subject bleachers, but instead hired subcontractors to perform inspections and maintenance of the bleachers. Bros's conclusory affidavit, which failed to identify the subcontractor who performed the last inspection or maintenance on the bleachers, as well as when and how such inspection or maintenance was performed, was insufficient to establish the school district's lack of constructive notice of the alleged dangerous condition. Next is E.W. versus City of New York on page 20, another premises liability case against a school. The second department held defendant school, which was sued as the New York City Department of Education, was entitled to summary judgment in this premises liability and negligent supervision action. Plaintiff third grader alleged a door closed on his finger, severing the tip. The school demonstrated it had no notice of any problems with the door, and supervision could not have prevented the accident. Next is the Swinney case, Swinney versus Nassau County, page 21, another premises liability case, this time dealing with the concept of an open and obvious condition. The second department held that wood from a split rail fence, which had fallen to the ground, was open and obvious, and was therefore not actionable in this slip and fall case. The court wrote, a landowner has a duty to maintain its premises in a reasonably safe condition. There is, however, no duty to protect or warn against conditions that are open and obvious and not inherently dangerous. Here, the defendants established their entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that the wood on the ground was open and obvious and not inherently dangerous. Next is Ralderis on pages 21 and 22. And it has to do with the issue of proximate cause of an injury. It's a premises liability case. The second department held plaintiff failed to demonstrate the allegedly defective swing was the proximate cause of his injury. Plaintiff alleged the swing was crooked, causing his daughter to begin to slip off the seat, and he fractured his hand trying to stop the swing. Second department noted that the assumption of risk doctrine did not apply in this scenario. The court wrote, as a general rule, application of assumption of the risk should be limited to cases such as personal injury claims arising from sporting events, sponsored athletic and recreative activities, or athletic and recreational pursuits that take place at designated venues. The court went on, it is not reasonably foreseeable that the allegedly negligent installation of the swing, which caused it to swing crookedly, would have resulted in the plaintiff jamming his hand on the back of the swing and fracturing his hand. The alleged negligent installation of the swing merely furnished the occasion for the unrelated act of the plaintiff reaching out to grab the swing and jamming his hand. So the condition of the swing was not the proximate cause of the injury. Next is CT versus Board of Education of South Glens Falls Central School District. On pages 22 and 23, it's another proximate cause case, this time dealing with bullying. The third department held the verdict finding the school district was negligent, but further finding that the negligence was not the proximate cause of plaintiff student's suicide was not against the weight of the evidence. Plaintiffs alleged bullying at the school was the reason for their son's suicide and claimed the school was liable under a negligent supervision theory. The court wrote, the conduct of defendants' employees was not blameless. Indeed, it appears that several minor incidents involving decedent provided missed opportunities for them to uncover what was going on. But the fact remains that the trial proof neither established the degree of the bullying that the decedent received at school, nor showed that defendant could have anticipated its impact upon him. Therefore, the jury could logically find that defendant was negligent by failing to adequately supervise decedent in some respects, but that the pain, suffering, and suicide of decedent were not foreseeable consequences of that negligence. Next is El Sawi versus Saratoga Springs City School District, pages 23 and 24. It's another premises liability case against the school, and this time it involves the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. The third department held the jury in this personal injury action was properly instructed on the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, a riser used for a choral rehearsal collapsed as plaintiff was walking on it. The court wrote, to be entitled to a res ipsa loquitur jury charge, a plaintiff must establish, one, that the injurious event is of a kind that ordinarily does not occur in the absence of someone's negligence, two, that the event was caused by an agency or instrumentality within the exclusive control of the defendant, and three, that the event was not due to any voluntary action or contribution on the part of the plaintiff. The evidence established that the auditorium was locked whenever it was not in use, and that defendants' agents exclusively assembled, disassembled, maintained, and repaired the risers. Plaintiff was not required to conclusively eliminate the possibility that someone intentionally disengaged the locking mechanism. Rather, all that was required was that the likelihood of an intentional act be so reduced that the greater probability lies at defendant's door. Next is Gerke versus Mustang Sally's Spirits and Grill on page 24. It's a respondeat superior case. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's action against the owner of a defendant strip club for injuries incurred when plaintiff was arm wrestling with defendant's employee should have been dismissed. Defendant's employee was not acting within the scope of his employment, and defendant therefore could not be liable under a respondeat superior theory. The court wrote, "The uncontroverted evidence submitted by defendants demonstrated that although the employee had various responsibilities at the club, he was not required to entertain the club's patrons, and he arm wrestled plaintiff out of personal motives unrelated to any of his job responsibilities." Next is Gregory versus National Amusements. It's on page 25. It's another respondeat superior case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the security guard's employers, that's SEBs, motion for summary judgment in this third-party assault case should have been granted. Plaintiff alleged the security guard attacked her without provocation. The security guard alleged he acted in self-defense after plaintiff and others attacked him. The employer would not be liable in either scenario. The court wrote, "Under plaintiff's version of events, SEB, that's the employer, could not be held liable because SEB's employee's unprovoked assault on Gregory with a box cutter was not within the scope of any duties he may have had as a security guard and was not done in furtherance of SEB's business interests. Under the security guard's version of events, even assuming for purposes of this appeal that his actions were within the scope of his duties as a security guard and were done in furtherance of SEB's business interests, SEB would not be held liable because the security guard's actions were taken in self-defense after being attacked by patrons of the movie theater." Next is the Leach Henry case on page 25. It's a slip and fall case, and it gives rise to issues involving landlord-tenant and municipal law. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant, a tenant in the building abutting the sidewalk, could not be held liable for a sidewalk defect which allegedly caused plaintiff's slip and fall. The court wrote, "Pursuant to Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 7-210A, the owner of real property abutting any sidewalk has a duty to maintain such sidewalk in a reasonably safe condition. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, the owner of real property abutting any sidewalk shall be liable for any injury to property or personal injury, including death, proximately caused by the failure of such owner to maintain such sidewalk in a reasonably safe condition. As a general rule, the provisions of a lease obligating a tenant to repair the sidewalk do not impose on the tenant a duty to a third party. However, where a lease agreement is so comprehensive and exclusive as to sidewalk maintenance, as to entirely displace the landowner's duty to maintain the sidewalk, the tenant may be liable to a third party. Here the defendant, tenant, established its entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that it did not create the alleged defect, make special use of the sidewalk, violate any applicable statute, or have a contractual duty to maintain the sidewalk where the accident occurred." So again, under those conditions, the tenant could not be held liable for a defect in the sidewalk. Next is D'Angelo versus City of New York on pages 26 and 27, another slip and fall case that involves municipal law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the city did not demonstrate it relinquished maintenance responsibilities for a parking lot licensed to a bus company in the slip and fall case. The court wrote, the permit agreement provided that the bus company had some responsibility for maintenance of the premises, but that the permit also was revocable at will by the city, and the city reserved the right at all times to free and uninterrupted access to any portion of the premises. Moreover, the deposition testimony submitted by the city established that the city employees made regular visual inspections of the premises. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to plaintiff, it cannot be said as a matter of law that the city relinquished control of the premises to the bus company such that it owed no duty to the plaintiff to remedy the allegedly defective condition. Next is Figueroa on page 27, landlord-tenant case involving smoke detectors. The First Department held the defendant landlord could not be liable for the failure to ensure a smoke detector was functional. The court wrote, in this action where plaintiff alleges that he was injured as a result of a fire in his apartment due to the defendant building owner's negligent failure to provide an operable smoke detector, defendant demonstrated that he satisfied his statutory duty to provide a functional smoke detector in the apartment, and accordingly, the obligation to maintain the smoke detector was assumed by the plaintiff, the tenant. And it references Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 27-2045. So under the New York Administrative Code, the landlord's duty stops after providing the tenant with a functional smoke detector. Next is the Clotter case, C-L-O-T-T-E-R, page 28. It's a third-party assault case involving, again, the landlord-tenant. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant New York City Housing Authority's motion for summary judgment in this third-party assault case should not have been granted. Plaintiff raised questions of fact whether the assailant was an intruder and whether the New York City Housing Authority had notice of the defective entrance door to the apartment building. The court wrote, from plaintiff's familiarity with building residents, the history of ongoing criminal activity, and the assailant's failure to conceal his or her identity, a jury could reasonably infer that the assailant was more likely than not an intruder. Contrary to New York City Housing Authority's contention, there's enough evidence as to how the assailant gained entry to the building to require consideration of whether New York City Housing Authority had actual or constructive notice of the non-functioning door lock. A jury could infer from plaintiff's testimony that the assailant entered the building himself and did not need to wait for anyone in the lobby to open the door for him. Nor does its evidence demonstrate that New York City Housing Authority did not have constructive notice of the non-functioning door lock, since plaintiff testified that the lock was not functioning the day before and the day of the incident, but the last daily maintenance checklist produced by the New York City Housing Authority, which included the front door lock, was dated 2 days before the incident. Next is Ballantyne. On page 29, a traffic accident case involving a bicyclist. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant driver, Perrone, did not eliminate questions of fact concerning whether he was negligent in traveling too fast for conditions or in keeping a proper lookout. Plaintiff bicyclist was struck while trying to see around a construction wall separating the bicyclist from the traffic. The court said, the defendants failed to eliminate tribal issues of fact as to whether Perrone kept a proper lookout or was traveling at a reasonable and prudent speed as he approached the intersection in light of the conditions then present. Next is Kramer on page 30, another traffic accident case. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict in this traffic accident case should have been granted. Defendant made a left turn in front of plaintiff's motorcycle. The court wrote, as the court charged the jury, defendant had a common law duty to see that which he should have seen through the proper use of his senses. The evidence undisputedly established that the area of the accident did not have any obstruction and that defendant had a clear line of sight of oncoming traffic. Inasmuch as defendant admitted at trial that he never saw plaintiff or his motorcycle prior to the accident, we conclude that the finding that defendant was not negligent could not have been reached on any fair interpretation of the evidence. So the defense verdict was set aside. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this January 2020 negligence update CLE. The verification code is left turn. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this January 2020 negligence update CLE is left turn. Okay, the final case in this CLE is on pages 30 and 31, matter of Wilkinson. It has to do with negligence under the estates, powers, and trusts law. Second Department, reversing surrogates court, held the 1992 agreement substituting life insurance for trust assets was covered by the estates, powers, and trust law, section 11-1.7. And the trustee, which owned the policies, was liable in negligence for failing to ensure the premiums were paid. The policies had lapsed. The provision of the trust asset substitution agreement exonerating the trustee from liability was invalid as against public policy, and the matter was remitted for a determination of damages. The court wrote, "The duty of the trustee was governed by Estates, Powers, and Trust Law, section 11-1.7, which states that the exoneration of a testamentary trustee from liability for failure to exercise reasonable care, diligence, and prudence is contrary to public policy." And that concludes this January 2020 negligence update CLE.